Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page, and I'd like to welcome back my guest co-host, Dr. Bob Gwyther.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah, glad to have you again, Bob. On our show today, we will be talking with Dr. Mike Pignoni, Chief of General Internal Medicine at UNC Chapel Hill, about prevention, doing what counts. This will be a little bit of the choir preaching to the choir, but we are looking forward to having him and to sharing with our listeners our passion for prevention and for really prioritizing tests and screenings that make sense for our patients. But first, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about concussions.
And we're going to talk about strep throat. How soon can you get your kid back to school after treatment?
And we're going to talk about surgery and control of type 2 diabetes.
And we're going to present a marketing study from a business school about what sort of imagery adolescents respond to when it comes to starting smoking.
Mm-hmm. All right. First, let's talk about athletes and concussions. So this was a report in the British Journal of Sports Medicine where they looked at 89 peer review articles and really tried to identify both what kinds of strategies should we employ to try to reduce concussions in sports, and are messages to athletes really working?
And what they're trying to do is they're going to try to improve on the baseline of 25 to 60% of hockey players who continue to play even though they have symptoms of concussion, and some other screenings that had been done that showed multiples of 30 times the number of people have actual concussive symptoms that'll tell their coach about it.
Yeah, so to the kids or players that are adults don't report the concussions as often as they actually disclose on confidential surveys. So unreported concussions range from 20 to 50% among college football, hockey, soccer, and rugby players.
And this is all driven by the sad fact that a lot of NFL players and other high contact sports players have had repeated concussions and gotten early dementia. Pugilistic dementia is the one that they named after the boxers. And we're trying to find a way to deal with that. But we can't deal with it if people don't pay attention and report symptoms.
Yeah, and that's hard for an athlete who wants to play. And now they know that if they speak up about it, they're probably going to get pulled and might not be able to play again. So it's hard to sort of really think about the future and traumatic brain injury when you want so much to get back in that game.
And these researchers are trying to encourage either federations of athletes or people like the NFL or the NCAA or actual legislation in the nation or the states to force more people to learn about this, not just the athletes, but the coaches, the trainers, everybody involved. And then if a kid or an adult gets symptomatic from concussion, that they need to do some things for sure.
Well, that's exactly right. I think sharing the responsibility, not just on the athlete, but making sure we're all thinking about it from policy and from employing the coaches, the parents, the athletes themselves, the peers, to be sure that everyone's speaking up to protect our brains. All right, let's talk about strep throat and getting back to school.
Well, I think every parent who's had a kid with strep throat who suddenly has to take a day off their job because they got to stay home with the kid is going to like this, because essentially a bunch of doctors at Inova Children's Hospital in Virginia studied 111 children who were positive with beta strep. That's this bacteria that causes strep throat. And they just gave these kids a dose of amoxicillin and then saw them back less than 23 hours later to see if they repeated two different tests, had they eradicated the group B strep. And they did 91% of the time.
Yeah. So that group A strep gets in the throat, But the good news is that unless you're a strep carrier, just one dose of antibiotics helps clear it up very quickly. So, I mean, what they came out of this was looking to say that if a single dose of amoxicillin is ingested by the kid by 5 o'clock p.m., then that's 12 hours or more before the arrival at school the following day, then they should be able to go back to school the next day. So that increases kids' ability to go to school and learn, do what they're supposed to do, the parents to not have to miss work, and really has a lot of positive implications.
So we just have to get the word out to physicians that maybe the patients will help carry the questions to them with this one.
All right. Let's talk about surgery. Now, Bob, Adam and I have talked about this before, about gastric bypass surgery and just really a lot of evidence to show great benefit to patients who have diabetes and other medical problems from having gastric bypass surgery.
And we haven't been able to give the mechanism for why that occurs, but it's been pretty clear that that was the outcome of some surgery. So it's been recommended, let's get some randomized controlled studies and see if this actually happens. And this is an early one, maybe the first, I don't know that, where 60 patients were split into three groups. The first group got ordinary care, medical care, and the second two groups had surgical care. One was a simple gastric bypass, and another one was called a biliary pancreatic bypass, which is more complicated surgery, several more incisions, and sort of rehooking the bowel to shorten exposure of food to the gut. And what happened is the surgical patients did much better. They had immediate effects. The defect did not have to wait on weight loss in order to occur. It was an immediate effect. And they generally lowered their blood sugars. Surgical patients used significantly less cardiovascular medications and antidiabetic medications after that surgery, and they had estimated cardiovascular risk for heart attacks and strokes about half of the patients who continued medical treatment. And they also claimed to have better quality of life scores.
Yeah, it was really impressive to see that you had lower blood sugars, lower heart disease risk, and better quality of life scores in the group that did get the surgery. So this is yet another bit of information to say, you know, if you have diabetes and you're overweight, this is worth really talking with your doctor about and really going and talking to a gastric surgeon to see if you're a good candidate for this and if it might be something that really can benefit your life.
And it's going to drive the medical researchers to explain the phenomenon, because it happens. We know it happens, but we don't know why.
Well, I mean, some of it for sure is related just to the direct weight loss and the difference between the two, but there may be other factors involved.
No, I think there are going to be other factors, and we'll just have to wait and see.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about teenagers and ads that originally, and of course, you know, advertisements are there to get people to use the product. We know that cigarettes, when used as intended, kill people. And we know that that teenagers getting hooked on them, you know, give you a longer time to impact your life. And it's harder to get off when you get started and really hooked on them at a young age. So this is some stuff about the media.
And back in the 60s and I think 60s and 70s, there was laws passed to say you can't advertise cigarettes to kids.
Which is interesting because, I mean, on cartoons, if you go back and look at old cartoons, Tom and Jerry and different things, I mean, you see there was just always some random person smoking, like just an animal, just various things that were used to sort of sneak in those advertisements.
And the
you can't do that anymore.
The laws said you couldn't give adolescents exposure in advertising to people under 25. Mm-hmm. And so actually it turns out that they probably knew that the adolescents respond best to people 25. And this study shows that if you have adolescents in the ads, the adolescents don't respect that, and they claim lower tendency to want to smoke. If they're older people over 40, same thing. They have a lower tendency to smoke. They don't identify with them, but they identify with the 25-year-old. That's who I want to be. And by gum, they're increase their likelihood to smoke after seeing the ad.
Because they're looking up to the 25-year-old. I thought maybe it was that if they were putting the older smokers in the ads just because they tend to be more wrinkly and have other, you know. And if you smoke, you get more wrinkles. And, you know, maybe there are smokers who look sick, that would not look as attractive. But this is more just targeted at those young people who are just older than who they are, and that's who they want to be. So this is the kind of thing that we need to continue to create policy around, but also need to talk with our kids, talk with our children about what's happening, why people are putting that in the advertisements, to be sure that we're countering the message. That does conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Mike Pignoni about prevention. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Bob Gwyther. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and our guest co-host, Dr. Catherine Coe. Today on Conversations, Catherine, we'll be talking with Dr. Mike Pignoni, Chief of General Internal Medicine at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, about prevention, doing what counts.
Welcome, Dr. Pignoni. We're so happy to have you here today.
Thanks, Catherine, and thanks, Christy.
So as family docs, Christy and I, prevention is something that's really important to us and really important in what we do and share with our patients to try and kind of help the health of our patients. Wondering if you wouldn't mind sharing with our listeners what prevention really is.
Well, I think you really touched on it in a couple ways. So to me, prevention is about preventing the untoward events that, you know, by them not happening, allow people to do the things that they want to do in their lives. So it, to me, it's the patient-centered element of it, you know, really just looking at the things that people are able to do and like to do and trying to keep them able to do those things.
Mm-hmm. And how did this become the area for you as a physician that became sort of your area of focus and expertise?
I've always been interested in the idea of preventive health and public health, probably really going back to before I ever went to medical school. So when I thought about what I'd like to be as a doctor, you know, like when I was in college or something, the idea of doing primary care and really having a close relationship with patients was pretty important. But, you know, in terms of what to work on, I thought, you know, well, one of the things that we have to do in primary care is be the voice for prevention, because many of the other specialties rightly devote their energy to curative medicine. And really, I feel like primary care has to own prevention, at least in the clinical setting.
Absolutely. So that also leads me to, when you're talking about primary care, people go to their doctor and talk about getting the general physical. You know, I'm here for my physical. And one of the things I'd hoped to get you to talk about is how what patients think about what is a general physical, and then what is it really with respect to prevention?
That's a really good question, and you know, it's been a topic that's been in the news a lot lately. I think it's really just, first of all, a problem of terminology. Rather than focusing on the physical exam aspects, I like to focus on kind of what we'd call the periodic health exam or annual wellness exam, because mm-hmm. to me, that really gets closer at what we really ought to be focusing on. It just turns out that there aren't a lot of physical exam things. There are a few, but most of the things we need to do in a prevention-oriented visit really are things that come up in a discussion between the patient and the doctor, and, you know, a couple physical exam things and then some lab tests. But fortunately, there's good evidence-based guidance about what should go into periodic. And it's not necessarily annual. I'd say sometimes it is. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's every 2 years or every 3 years, you know, a periodic health visit.
And how do you manage that expectation with your patients? I'm sure Catherine and I could tell our own stories. Yeah. But, you know, someone comes in and they're here for their physical, and you do this long visit, and you've talked about all these different beautiful elements of weighing out different screenings and things to keep them healthy. And then at the end, I'm sure you manage this much better, but I still have these times where obviously I didn't explain it well enough what we were doing, because it's like, well, you know, aren't you going to look in every hole? And,
right.
you know, that people, some really have this expectation and need mm-hmm. that we're going to that that has value, and that's why they're there looking right. in all these different holes, their eyes and their ears and everywhere, versus focusing on that prevention.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, and I don't blame the patients because they really have absorbed a level of expectation that's really, I think, in many cases been set by the medical community about what does and doesn't have value.
And when it's called the physical exam, well, you're going to expect that they're going to examine me from head to toe.
And it makes sense. I mean, you have to be really good at physical exam skills to be a good doctor, but they need to be deployed strategically, not kind of just generally. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think, you know, in the prevention visit, we end up doing some things probably for one very good reason, which is that there is, I really believe, some level of value that comes from touching your patients.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we've talked about, like, you know, a hand on the shoulder communicates so much.
Right.
So, you know, some of these things, you know, really could be done over a telephone or remotely, but I do think there is some value in actually having a face-to-face conversation and laying on of hands. I mean, you see the Pope's visit, it's pretty powerful, right? Laying hands on somebody.
Yeah.
And I think that translates to the medical setting. That said, I think you can do that without necessarily examining every orifice. And, you know, fortunately, like I said, we have some pretty good science to figure out what we should or shouldn't be doing in the exam and the periodic health assessment. So that can really provide guidance. And I think now the challenge is communicating that to patients so that they understand what they should or should not be getting in an annual or periodic health visit.
I love the way that you reframe the term annual physical exam to periodic health maintenance or annual wellness exam. And you mentioned that we're using evidence-based methodologies to describe to our patients what they should and should not be getting as far as prevention. You serve on the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, which for Christy and I, it's kind of our go-to thing that we use to use those evidence-based guidelines of what we should be doing. Wondering how you got involved with it and what are some recommendations that you guys think are most important for our patients these days?
Sure. Well, the Preventive Services Task Force has been around for quite a long time now. I actually first was involved with the task force right when I first started on the faculty at UNC. So like in 1998, we were doing support work for the task force. We're one of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality's evidence-based practice centers. And at that time, I was working on doing the systematic reviews that underlie the task force work. So I did that work for about 4 or 5 years early in my career, did a lot of the systematic reviews that the task force used at that time to make decisions, and then, you know, rotated out of that work, did some other work for a while, and then came back to it as a task force member over the last couple of years. And, you know, the task force is an independent body that is convened by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, but is separate from it, that, you know, brings together experts in preventive care. So internists, family physicians, pediatricians, people with expertise in population health, nurses, you know, to really take a strong look at the evidence and try to make some recommendations that are helpful to clinical providers as they think about what should be provided for preventive services.
Well, I know we're going to talk about Catherine's question around, you know, what things are most important maybe for a couple specific patients. But I wonder if you would speak a little bit to the harms. One of the things that I appreciated and really grew to learn during my public health training, where we were very much learning about the USPSTF and its recommendations and how it works, but it's the thought, the factors that the task force considers around harm, that sometimes doing things to people or for people can cause harm, and that's part of what we have to factor into the picture. Could you give us an example of maybe something that we used to do that we discovered maybe is harmful if you do it to everyone, or just some example that touches on this concept of harm?
Yeah, I think one really good example comes out of the physical exam. And when I was in medical school, one of the things that we got taught was how to listen to someone's carotid arteries.
Mm-hmm.
All right, the carotid artery is an artery that goes through your neck to your brain. Blood flow to your brain is obviously important. And so the idea was that if we listen to the carotid artery, we'll hear these things called Bruis, which suggests that the blood flow may be narrowed through the carotid artery, and that could be a risk factor for stroke. People have incorporated that into kind of annual physical exams. Well, it turns out that in someone without any symptoms, listening for carotid bruits isn't a very accurate way of finding people who are at high risk for stroke by itself. And really, if you follow a pathway or a cascade, as we call it, from listening for carotid bruise to then doing ultrasounds and then potentially doing surgery on people, there's an opportunity to harm them if they're not at high enough risk to have the benefits of surgery outweigh the downsides of surgery. So that's an example where I think at this day and age, we shouldn't be listening to asymptomatic patients next. Instead, we should be asking them about risk factors for strokes and whether they've had any stroke symptoms. This is one of those things where you convert something from the physical exam to something to the history and risk factor assessment.
Right. So that requires more talking with the patient and going through some of those risk factors and modifying those, but not so much of the laying hands, as we were talking before. So trying to figure out how to balance that.
Yeah, in this case, just not putting the stethoscope on the neck in an asymptomatic person. But, you know, we had to figure that out through good research. So I want to put in a plug, you know, for doing the research to figure out whether these preventive services really help or do they hurt or do they help some people and hurt others, right? So you have to do good studies. And it wasn't until that was studied that we really had the data to say, you know, look, in an asymptomatic person, this is probably not a great idea.
Well, gosh, this is just the beginning of an exciting conversation to us, all of us who really care deeply about prevention. We do need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Mike Pignoni, Chief of General Internal Medicine at UNC Chapel Hill. We're talking about prevention, doing what counts. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Catherine Koh. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Catherine Koh. We've been talking with Dr. Mike Pignoni, Chief of General Internal Medicine at UNC Chapel Hill, about prevention, doing what counts. Now, in the earlier segment, we were talking about the evidence behind some of the prevention that doctors recommend, and also about communication between the physician as well as the patient. In our clinic, for Christy and I, it's, and I'm sure for you as well, it's really important that we have kind of a give and take with our patients, that the physician knows what prevention is recommended, and then the patient also has a certain level of responsibility to kind of know about what would be recommended for them. So it's really a team-based system. Who else is part of this team for, or who else should patients think is part of this team?
I really want to give a shout out to nurses. So one of the things that we've learned in our practice is that if we really want to do prevention right, we have to engage the whole team, and especially nurses. So for instance, the recommendations for immunizations for adults are getting a little bit more and more complex every year as we get new effective vaccinations. And in our clinic, our nurses own vaccination. So really, I almost never have a discussion, unless a patient has a particular question, about whether to get a pneumonia shot or a flu shot or the shingles vaccine. Our nurses take care of that. And, you know, ideally, they do that in a very give-and-take, patient-centered way, and it just adds more opportunity during the visit for the patient to get what they need. Then that gives me the time to focus on some of the more complex or harder questions, like, you know, whether you should be screened for prostate cancer, or whether you should have a mammogram at age 40 versus age 50, or what kind of colon cancer screening should you have. And those are discussions that I feel like we need to spend some time with patients to have well, but you don't need to do it every year, right? So my general idea is I want to have one really good conversation with the person and then, you know, say to them, all right, we've made this decision, let's just say, to pursue colonoscopy screening. We're going to keep doing our colonoscopy screening every 10 years. But if you tell me differently that you no longer want to do that or something changes in your condition, we can always revise the plan. But if the idea was that we had to redo from scratch every decision every year, that's when you get to this problem with there's not enough hours in the day to do all of preventive care.
Mm-hmm. Right. But by using the team to have nurses and other staff members help with the things that are more automated, like the immunizations, as you're saying, or maybe the diabetic foot exam, if they haven't had one, that they could go ahead and help out with that. that there could be, and roles with the pharmacist of thinking, you know, outreach about medications, if people are on their proper medications for diabetes and those kinds of things, those quality metrics really do take a team approach. Because if a doctor does it, then there's not enough time to get through it all. I think that time thing is hard.
That's right.
It's hard for patients, and it's hard for doctors as well, that if we really explain every single thing every single year, we wouldn't actually take care of anyone.
That's right. So we really got to think about how to use our time most valuably, because really for doctors like us in primary care, our time is what we're really – that's our value, right? Mm-hmm. That's what we offer people. So, I mean, just as an example, I went to the UNC Family Medicine Center 2 weeks ago, and my doctor there is an excellent doctor, Dr. Clark Denniston, and I emailed him in advance. He put in the order. I had my blood drawn to check my cholesterol because it hadn't been checked in 5 years, and also to screen me for diabetes because I'm in the age category and I have a family history, so that makes good sense for me. These are both preventive services recommended services. And was able to have that information when I went into the visit, first with my nurse who took my blood pressure. And then while I was waiting between seeing the nurse and Dr. Denniston, I got out my smartphone, right, went to cvriskcalculator.com, put in my information. And by the time he got into the room, we had the same information available to each of us. I could show him on my smartphone that my risk for heart disease over the next 10 years was low and that we didn't need to do anything differently. And, you know, that... You know, so that's a way to use technology in the whole team to take what could have been a 15 or 20 or even, you know, 24-hour process if I had to get my blood drawn after the visit and do it in a shrunken period of time that best used his time with me.
Now, of course, you're a doctor and an expert in prevention, so you had more coming into that visit than most patients. What do you think are most important things for our listeners to either think about or consider maybe before their annual wellness exam or as they're coming in that people could do to prepare and maybe help guide their physician and that team to take care of them most efficiently and best?
Well, first of all, I think that the healthcare system itself needs to reach out to people proactively about preventive care. So a lot of the stuff, I mean, getting your flu shot, that doesn't have to happen in the doctor's office. It can happen where it's convenient to the patient, right? So we should reach out for the things that we know people need to do and that don't really depend on an individualized conversation. And then secondly, I think, you know, some pre-visit preparation, either initiated by the patient or initiated by the healthcare system, can be really helpful. I'm really big on agenda setting. So if there was one thing that I could, you know, magically make happen differently, I would want the patient to spend a little bit of time thinking about what are the three things I most want to talk about during the visit, and either send those to me in advance or at least just bring them to the visit and tell me them at the start of the visit. And then what I tend to do, you know, on my best days is I get the patient's agenda. I've pre-screened their chart, and I have my agenda of things that I need to do that may not be on their list at all.
Right.
And to a mutual list.
Yeah, they may not know they need colon cancer screening if you didn't pick
up
on that.
You don't know what you don't know. So you can't just rely on what the patient wants, right? I mean, so we do bring some information to that visit. So then there's a process of negotiation. We prioritize the things that we can get done during that visit. You know, and then we sometimes might need to put something off to the next visit, but hopefully we hit the main things. Everyone's happy and, you know, good health is achieved. And I think, you know, the closer we can get to that kind of a process using the electronic tools, you know, prudently, that makes me most optimistic about the future for care, because I feel like right now we still have some room to go to really take advantage of all the tools that, you know, if you go to get your oil changed or, you know, go to the grocery store, we're increasingly seeing, and that we haven't actually brought into healthcare quite as much as some other industries have.
I think that's so important, talking about agenda setting. As a resident, that's still something I'm very much learning how to do. But utilizing, like you're saying, things like the MyChart app to communicate with patients and having them bring in their agendas, I think, really kind of gets you the most bang for your buck as a patient and a provider in the short amount of time that we have.
I mean, the thing that always for doctors is really hardest is you've gone through your visit, you used up all your time, you're on time, and just as you're about to walk out the door, and the patient says, oh, there's one more thing.
Yep.
And, you know, that's, you know, sometimes that one more thing is the most important thing to them. So we've got to figure out ways to increase the chance that those things get on the table up front, and we prioritize that way. That way we stay efficient, we're not late for the next patient, and we hit what the patient wants to talk about.
So, I mean, you are an expert in clinical quality and thinking about prevention. As we relate that to prevention, where do you think are the key areas we need to improve nationally in terms of prioritizing prevention and keeping people healthy?
You know, I think we're doing a mediocre to good job in most areas of prevention. We just need to do it more consistently. And, you know, probably, I guess the other thing I'd say is that there are a lot of people without access to good primary care right now. So really solving the problem of uninsuredness and access to care is as much as anything going to make a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, I think we're not doing bad. It's just that we need to get more consistent and do it without losing the patient-centeredness of the visit. So a lot of times with the prevention topics, they aren't things by definition that the patient comes in complaining about. So if we exclude all the things that the patient is symptomatic with or wants to talk about in order to get all of our prevention things done, that might not be a good outcome, right? So it's really this process of negotiation and an ongoing relationship that I think is really the key to doing this well.
Well, in follow-up to your comments about reframing the term physical examination to an annual wellness visit, it really does help our patients think about staying well, being well, embracing health. And we will have our health sciences librarians put up a link about what is the annual wellness visit and maybe some of the Medicare language around the Medicare wellness visit as well onto our blog to try to help our listeners. Are there any other parting words for our listeners in thinking about keeping themselves healthy?
Well, I mean, the one area we haven't really talked about today is the whole area of health that has nothing to do with the clinical relationship. So really, you know, giving people a chance to exercise, you know, to eat healthy, to have access to healthy foods, and a lot of the things about the built environment that are really more public health or political questions than they are clinical questions is still, you know, very important. And I think our role as clinicians there is to be advocates for our patients and to, you know, attempt to move the national discussion in a direction of healthier environments. And that's really important because that really kind of underlies all the clinical work that we're going to do afterwards.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for your leadership in this area nationally and for your work to take care of patients right here locally as well.
Yeah.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. We've been talking with Dr. Mike Pignone, Chief of General Internal Medicine at UNC Chapel Hill, about prevention, doing what counts.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Catherine Koh. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Bob and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have a question you'd like us to address, please send it to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our executive producer, Daniel Lane, to read us the very first House Call question.
My six-year-old son has asthma and started wheezing badly last night after he caught a cold from my daughter. We took him to a local urgent care, and they treated him with a nebulizer, which made the wheezing stop. He's doing much better this morning. He has two inhalers at home when he needs them, one for wheezing and one with steroids in it, and we are using both. But the doctor in the urgent care gave me a prescription for an antibiotic called amoxicillin. Do we really need to fill that?
Well, that is really tricky. It's good to hear that your son is much better. That can be really, really scary when a child with asthma is wheezing really badly. I'm glad that he's better. And there are a couple little things that jump out at me. For one, to your question, does he really need the antibiotic? Well, it sounds like if he hasn't had any antibiotic, he's better. You've got the inhalers on board, and you don't, I mean, and he's so much better, then this is probably a virus, and he probably doesn't need that antibiotic. instincts are probably right on that. A lot of times in the urgent care, they don't know which way it's going to turn, or they don't have enough information or the ability to see you back. And so sometimes, they write a prescription because you might need it. And in this case, it turns out you might not.
And a lot of physicians these days are really looking for ways to cut back on the places where they use antibiotics because it's leading to resistance in all kinds of bacteria. And, of course, they're no good for viruses in this case.
Yeah. And so the other thing that jumps out is have these two different inhalers to use when he needs them, and one for wheezing and one with the steroids in it. So one of those is intended to be used every day for a period of time, whether it seems like he's wheezing or not. And then the other one, which is usually albuterol or Ventolin, is supposed to be given when he needs it, and sometimes more often during times when he has a virus. So I would encourage you to take those specific inhalers, like get them in hand, put them in your purse or your bag, and bring them to his doctor and really review and be sure you understand which one's supposed to be given, every day, regardless, and which one is just for when he's wheezing. And together that can really help prevent the kind of situation that you had last night. Good luck to you. Let's take our next house call question.
I went to the drugstore yesterday and saw signs in the pharmacy saying they gave flu shots. Is it okay to go there instead of my doctor's office? It is much more convenient for me to go there.
Well, this is the age-old question. We're physicians. We like to see people, and we like them to come to our practice. On the other hand, a flu shot is a flu shot, and as far as I know, the pharmacies are using the same thing that gets recommended to the doctor's offices, and if you can be in and out of there in a hurry, it's going to save you some time. Your doctor might not like that if your insurance is one of the ones that makes the doctor's office keep track of all the shots they give so that they can measure it at the insurance headquarters, and sometimes there's financial implications. I don't think most pharmacists are doing a good job of letting somebody know that you got your flu shot over at the insurance company.
Right. They might fax a sheet of paper over that kind of gets in the mix. But and some insurances are starting to tie getting certain screenings and things like flu shots done with your copays or with your other fees. So you do want to try to make sure that you have documentation somewhere that you did get it done. I agree with you, Bob. Like, just get your flu shot. If it's easier for you to, wherever it's going to allow you to get it done, that's the most important thing. And then this documentation, might sway you a little bit. Let's take our next house call question.
My 14-year-old daughter can never predict when her menstrual period is going to start, which is sometimes difficult when she is at school. And she has a lot of cramping when she does get them. Is this normal, and is there anything we can do to help?
This is, for one, you should know, this is really common. So a lot of times during the teenage years, girls are not ovulating regularly, and so they're not having regular menstrual cycles. And that's pretty common, that during these times they've had a period, but they're not sort of on a regular routine of having it exactly every single month. And that can be sort of scary to the child. It can be concerning, especially if they think they might be pregnant. And sometimes those periods when they come can be, really crampy and painful. And as you mentioned, really inconvenient if it's happening at random times at school. So it's a common situation. Time usually makes it better. But there are a couple of things that you could do if you're so inclined.
One thing is you can send some stuff to school she can keep in her locker or keep it in her purse so that if this happens, she's prepared.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people use a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug like ibuprofen or naproxen, and that seems to help. Heating pads help some kids, especially when they're laying in bed at night.
Mm-hmm. And then some people, if it's so uncomfortable and traumatic, will be on birth control pills, which sort of regulate things a little bit and help reduce the worry about an unintended pregnancy, particularly if the child is or might become sexually active. So those are things to think about. Talk to your doctor about it, and really stay in open communication with your daughter. That's a really good question. And let's take our next house call question.
I'm a 35-year-old male, and I'm very athletic. I run, swim, or play ultimate frisbee almost every day. I recently saw my doctor for a routine checkup, and after a blood glucose screening, he said that I might be pre-diabetic. What does being pre-diabetic mean? How could that happen to me when I'm so active, and what can I do about it?
Well, what it means is that your blood sugar hopefully a fasting blood sugar, was over 120. And it could be a positive screen. Plenty of fit, non-obese, cardiovascularly exercised people are diabetic. And so you have to look into this and find out what this, whether you really have it or not. You need to get the next level of testing from the screen in order to determine that.
Yeah. And I mean, considering you are young and athletic, and it sounds like maybe not overweight, it's very possible that the test was a mistake and that somehow maybe you weren't fasting when you had it done, or there's some thing. So getting it repeated is the right thing to do. And then, you know, if you do have it because you have some genetic predisposition, something passed down in your family or something, then finding out about it on the early side is a really good thing to do so that you can move forward and optimize your health. It's a great, great question, and we wish you all the best and hope that it was just a mistake. Let's take our next that was our last house call question of the day. Thank you, Daniel, for sharing some great questions. Thank you to our listeners for writing some good questions for us today. We want to encourage all of our listeners to share your questions, share your stories. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, on our health app by searching Your Health One Word for a free download. And we just really hope that these issues and concerns have been helpful to you and helpful to your overall health today.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Mike Pignoni. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And this is Dr. Bob Gwyther.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.